This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the recent 35-day government shutdown. We'll take a look at what it means for chemical testing, food testing, and something that most listeners may not think about, cybersecurity. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Donald Trump set a record for the longest ever government shutdown in history, lasting nearly 35 days. There are many ways the public will feel the impact of a federal shutdown. 800,000 federal workers were either barred from working or forced to work without pay. That, despite the continued operation of so-called essential services, many of which relate to public safety, that continued to operate. In prior shutdowns, these have included border protection, in-hospital medical care, air traffic control, law enforcement, and power grid maintenance. In 2013, the Environmental Protection Agency halted site inspections to 1,200 different sites, including hazardous waste, drinking water, and chemical facilities. The Food and Drug Administration delayed nearly 900 inspections. Today, we'll examine how cybersecurity and food and chemical testing were impacted. We'll be joined by legislative attorney Melanie Benesch with the Environmental Working Group in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by technology writer Larry Loeb. We'll first hear from attorney Melanie Benesch with the Environmental Working Group in D.C. Melanie Benesch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
I understand that during a government shutdown, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's food inspections are curtailed. What exactly is the scope of such inspections? How many food facilities are impacted, and why should we care about that?
The FDA Commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, has gone on the record saying that FDA was working during the shutdown to continue inspecting certain high-risk inventory, like seafood and cheese and infant formula, which is about 31% of the domestic inspections that they do. But presumably, other foods that the FDA regularly sends inspectors to look at to make sure that it's not being contaminated, making sure that it's being handled in sanitary conditions, there was a lapse in those inspections. And that's certainly a public health concern, given some very high-profile cases over the last year of people getting sick from romaine lettuce and other foodborne illnesses.
Is food inspected at the borders?
The Washington Post, at least, has reported that imports and foreign manufactured goods were still being inspected by FDA and USDA at the borders.
What are the repercussions for a diminishing or reduction in food inspections? Should people be worried about what they buy, what they eat?
It certainly is. It's a security concern. It's a public safety concern. You know, we have robust laws in place regarding the way that food is monitored and inspected, and that supply lines are monitored to make sure that the FDA is in a position to know when there is a risk from a foodborne illness, or being able to trace the source of that foodborne illness if there's an outbreak like we saw in the romaine lettuce cases in the last year. When FDA's capacity is diminished and when personnel aren't able to be engaged in those inspection and monitoring and basic food safety activities, there is a risk to public health, and there is an increased likelihood that people may get sick from the foods that they buy. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot that your average consumer can do to protect themselves in periods of like a government shutdown where that service is interrupted.
What is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry? Does that have anything to do with our water supply, monitoring it?
So the ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, is an agency within the Center for Disease Control, and it's a federal public health agency, and their work is trying to protect community from harmful health effects related to exposure to hazardous substances. So they respond to environmental health emergencies. They investigate emerging environmental health threats, so chemicals of emerging concern. They do research on health impacts of hazardous waste sites. They communicate to communities about public health risks from hazardous substances. And so the work that they do is very important. They don't regularly monitor our drinking water, but they do monitor certain drinking water sites or groundwater sites as part of long-term studies that they do. And that is very important in just adding to the body of knowledge that we have about substances. The ATSDR earlier this year released a very important report on an emerging contaminant known as per- and polyalkyl fluoral substances, or better known as PFAS. And when an agency like the ATSDR has their funding disrupted, it really disrupts the continuity of that research, and so may put the agency in a position where they have to stop research and restart it. And then also, to the extent that there are public health emergencies that they need to communicate to communities, they're not able to do that as quickly or effectively. For example, I just saw on the ATSDR's website that they had scheduled a meeting to talk to veterans in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, which has had a long problem with contaminated drinking water that has resulted in several cases of cancer out of that community. And they had a meeting scheduled at Camp Lejeune to talk about the contaminated water and some of the health impacts, and that meeting had to be canceled because of the shutdown. So really, it disrupts the monitoring work that ATSDR is doing. It slows the reporting, and it prevents communities from getting needed information from the government.
Melanie, if you will, tell us a bit about the work that you do with the Environmental Working Group in D.C., and what is the organization's mission?
Sure. So the Environmental Working Group, we are an environmental health organization, and we're really committed to using the power of information to help inform consumer choices about their health and about chemicals in consumer products, and also public policy. So we have a number of databases that are consumer-facing that provide information about chemicals that are in your personal care products, that are in different home products, that are in food. We also have a tap water database, which is based on EPA data, monitoring different contaminants of concern in drinking water, and we have a clickable map that goes with that. In my work here is I'm the legislative attorney with EWG, and so I take a lot of that scientific research that our scientists do and try and translate that into policy solutions. So I work a lot with Congress, and we also work a lot with agencies like the FDA and the EPA as they are thinking through how to protect public health through policy.
Let's talk about chemicals for a minute. So there's a possibility we want to ensure that chemicals don't make their way into either drinking water or food. Are there other chemical-related issues that could pose a larger public safety concern, and would the government shutdown conceivably impact that?
Certainly. So we are exposed to chemicals from many different pathways. Food and water are two obvious ones, but there is also chemicals that we breathe in the air. There are chemicals in the soil or heavy metals in the soil that we can be exposed to. There are a number of consumer products like, say, your food packaging or your personal care products, or even whatever your carpets or furniture have been treated with. Chemicals accumulate in dust, and you can breathe them in that way, or you can touch them. So there are various ways that we are exposed to different environmental toxins, and various agencies work together to try and control the risks from those different chemical exposures. EPA is one of the primary agencies that works on this, and the EPA is constantly monitoring for the presence of toxic chemicals, heavy metals, and other pollutants in the air and water. But during the shutdown at sites across the country, from North Carolina to Alabama, those pollutants were all going unmonitored. And EPA is also responsible for taking enforcement actions against people who are violating the regulations that we do have, or whose inspections show that they're not in compliance with the law, or who have permits to discharge into water bodies or into the air and are exceeding those limits that they've agreed to. And so that enforcement is not happening, the monitoring isn't happening, and then, you know, the act of actually regulating how we're exposed to chemicals in our environment, that's a long, time-consuming process, and all of that was put on hold during the shutdown.
What is the line between chemical pollutants and chemical weapons that, say, could be unleashed in a public transportation system? Where does the EPA leave off and federal law enforcement take over in a matter like that?
In terms of security risks?
Well, in terms of the type of toxin that might be released airborne, say, does the EPA advise law enforcement? Say there were an attack in a major city. Does the EPA get involved at all in that, if it involves chemical weaponry?
You know, I'm not sure. Yeah. EPA may be involved in understanding the particular risks from those chemicals. I mean, a security risk from the shutdown that's related to this. The Department of Homeland Security has an Office of Health Affairs, and that office is responsible for assessing threats posed by infectious disease, pandemic, and also biological and chemical attacks. And according to the department's shutdown contingency plan, it is supposed to scale back during a shutdown. That is certainly a direct security risk.
That kind of threat becomes increasingly real these days.
Mm-hmm. Even if you still have employees who are not who are still working but may not be receiving pay because they've been furloughed, but they need to be doing there because the work is essential, you know, it's likely that those employees are probably not operating at their full capacity either, because if they don't know when they're going to get paid, if they've got bills or mortgages that are coming up, they have a lot of distressors that are distracting them from being able to do their best at their job, which is perfectly understandable. But we really want our federal employees to feel supported and to be able to show up at work, ready to do the work.
Melanie, what might a worst-case scenario look like? For example, if the government shutdown were to continue anew and go on for, say, 2 or 3 months, can you describe for listeners some worst-case scenarios?
I think a worst-case scenario is polluters taking the shutdown as a free pass because no testing is being done, no monitoring is being done, no enforcement is being done. And so polluters seeing this as an opportunity to really ignore the law and ignore the checks that we have in place. Another worst-case scenario is an emergency happening and EPA not being able to respond. So if you have a chemical emergency, you know, I think like we saw a couple years ago, I believe in Texas, where you had a chemical plant that exploded, and you have an emergency and you don't have the personnel ready to respond to that emergency. Or if you have some other kind of chemical spill and EPA is not able to respond, or you have new enforcement actions to take and the enforcement personnel are not able to start taking those actions. And then I think another sort of worst-case scenario is when you have federal workers that are feeling so pinched and so much pressure that they leave the work. And so even if the shutdown is over, you're left with fewer workers that are doing this important work and an incredible loss in institutional knowledge.
That's an excellent point. I think you were referring to a fertilizer plant in
Yes.
Texas. And also, as you were speaking, I was realizing one of the waste disposal or dumping could be nuclear waste, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That is terrifying. Melanie, does the shutdown directly impact your work in any way?
Yes, there are a couple of new policies that we are expecting out of EPA. This actually came up at Acting Administrator Wheeler's hearing. One of them is on a chemical called methylene chloride. Methylene chloride is a very deadly chemical. It's used in paint strippers. We have data that it's been responsible for over 60 deaths since 1980, including four in the past 2 years since this rule was proposed. So there's a proposed rule that would ban the use of methylene chloride in paint strippers, and it has been sitting with EPA and with the Office of Budget and Management for some time now, and we are expecting it to come out any day. That has not been able to move, despite assurances that it would move, in part because of the shutdown. There's also a lot of buzz in the news and a lot of attention around this group of emerging contaminants called per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS substances. This is a major drinking water contaminant that legislators and communities are very concerned about. It's tied to kidney cancer and a handful of other cancers. It has some immunological effects and is associated with a number of health risks that people are very concerned about. This is a big issue in Michigan and Pennsylvania and New York and Alaska, and really throughout the country. We estimate as many as 110 million people could be drinking water that has some level of these PFAS chemicals in them. EPA has also for months been saying that they are going to put out a national management plan related to these chemicals, detailing how the agency plans to address the risk from these chemicals. We have been waiting for that management plan. Some affected communities have been watching very closely, waiting for that plan to come out. Legislators who are going to be taking some legislative actions on this group of chemical this year also want to know what EPA's plan is, and that has also been held up because of the shutdown.
Where does that chemical originate from?
It's a synthetic chemical. It's been in production, I think, since the 40s. Most people know it as a Teflon chemical.
Oh.
So it's a group of non-stick, stain-resistant, water-repellent chemicals, and it has a variety of uses. It's used in food packaging. It's used in waterproof rain gear. It's used to cover carpeting and furniture for stain resistance. It's used in electroplating. It's used in firefighting foam. And then it's also a chemical byproduct in the production of other chemicals. So it's very ubiquitous. I think there's about, our EPA has estimated there's about 5,000 chemicals sort of in this group of chemicals. And it unfortunately is a very widespread water contaminant. Unfortunately, one characteristic of these chemicals is they don't break down in the environment, and they do accumulate in the human body. And so there is certainly an environmental and a public health risk that I think people all over the country are waking up to and realizing that we urgently need to do something about it.
I know we're deviating a bit, but this is so interesting. Does the water supply get contaminated by this when it's disposed of, or is it just coming into contact with all of these products?
So it gets into the water in a number of different ways. One major source of water contamination is actually from the use of firefighting foams, which are kept on military bases and airports. They are used, of course, to put out fire emergencies, but also during training exercises and sort of after you release all of that foam, it gets washed into the water. But it's also, released from factories that are using this. It can be emitted into the air and get into the water that way. And unfortunately, it's not one of the contaminants that is regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So water utilities at this moment are not required to test for or treat these chemicals. Some of them are doing it anyway, but it's not a requirement under the current law.
Can filters remove this?
Yes. So some of these chemicals can be removed even with a basic carbon or Brita filter, but they do need to be replaced regularly.
Has your job become more challenging with the new presidential administration?
Yes, in a word. We weren't quite sure what to expect, but I don't know that anyone was expecting that this administration would be so hostile to environmental protection. We have seen the rollback of several important environmental regulations. One law that I do a lot of work on is called the Toxic Substances Control Act. Congress actually totally rewrote this law in 2016. It was the most significant update to environmental laws, I think, in about 40 years. And it left a lot of important questions about implementation to the new administration coming in. And unfortunately, we have seen this law be written as narrowly as possible, or seen the implementing regulations be written as narrowly as possible in ways that we think are really not protective to public health. So that has been very frustrating, very disappointing, and ultimately, we think not what Congress intended.
And I assume that that is in part due to the lobbying of certain industries?
That may have something to do with it.
We are winding up. How can listeners learn more about the work that you do?
Sure. They can go to our website, www.ewg.org. We are also active on all your favorite social media platforms. So you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram to learn more about the work that we do. If consumers are interested in learning more about the products that they're using every day, we have several databases. We have a Skin Deep database where people can look up their personal care products and learn more about what's in them. We have a database called Food Scores where people can look up some of the different foods that they regularly buy and learn more about the nutrition and processing and any chemicals of concern. And then we also have a Healthy Home Guide and Tap Water database, which are all consumer-facing resources that we hope people can use to educate themselves about their own chemical exposure and things that they can do to protect their families.
Well, Melanie, that sounds like a must-have go-to resource during these times.
Yes.
Well, thank you for your wonderfully important work during these challenging times, and we appreciate your update on the government shutdown.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bye, Melanie. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We now speak with technology writer Larry Loeb on the issue of government computer systems and cybersecurity during a government shutdown. Larry Loeb, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Why, thank you for having me.
I'd like to start with something that many of our listeners may not give much thought to during a government shutdown, and that's the state of our already precarious national cybersecurity. Government agency websites and systems like NASA and the Department of Defense have experienced a number of high-profile attacks that go back decades. During this recent government shutdown, who was protecting those sites from malicious intrusion?
Well, there's two different mechanisms. The Department of Defense was not shut down by this latest theater. It had people who were on staff and tasked with maintaining the military networks as well. NASA, on the other hand, was not considered to be as mission critical as DOD was, and certain sites that they had, which were public facing, suffered from the lack of personnel that were available to maintain them.
Are you talking about I go on to the NASA website, and basically if I click on certain parts of it, it's not going to respond?
There can be a number of causes for a non-response. There may be nothing there to send back to you. There may also be what we noticed as far as the registration certificates that are used by the websites to communicate with the public expiring. There were a number of registration certificates that are used in the authentication process that expired during the partial shutdown.
That governs encryption as well, so it's a matter of protecting the information that's on the site or linked to their computer systems?
It's a way of protecting the information they're trying to share with the public during transit of that information. There is a protocol used universally called HTTPS, which basically uses these certificates to ensure the conversation between two parties occurs. It both identifies each party to each other and gives them a way to mathematically talk to each other so that if someone is listening, they cannot understand that conversation.
Larry, is a concern that personal data people might have, say, put on the IRS website, Social Security, is there a concern that that could be accessed by malicious hackers if the security certificate is not renewed?
No, not just because of the security certificate. That certificate does not delve into the government computers directly. It simply ensures that the conversations exist between the two parties. Now, if someone is hiding on the Starbucks Wi-Fi that you're using to connect to the IRS and there is no certificate in force, then yes, someone could listen in to any data you told the IRS. However, just the lack of the certificate by itself will not allow someone to get into the IRS computers.
Larry, talk, if you will, about some of the larger risks that a government shutdown like the one we just had might pose to our general national cybersecurity.
That happens to be a huge subject. It's far more than just whose certificates did not renew. The problem is, and this is a perspective that outside of government service you don't really come to, government data processing is not goal-oriented the same way that, say, an enterprise is. An enterprise may say, we want this program to do certain things for us, A, B, C, and D. Government data processing is, in general, compliance-oriented. There are checkboxes in the mission statement, if you will, that the government, the data processing has to meet. Whether or not they are effective towards some goal is not usually considered. If they are considered to be in compliance, a government data processing effort will go well. Having said that, that's a legacy approach from the mainframe days of computers when the government got into it. In the newer era of networked non-data center computers, there are some efforts like, for instance, the 18F effort, which is named that because it lives at 18th Street and F Street in Washington, trying to bring the government data processing efforts kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
I understand, as you're referring to, that many of our federal agencies are operating on really old systems, you know, some dating back to the 1970s with floppy disks. And I did read about that 18F.
It has bigger goals than just to bring up corporate goals. The problem is, in many ways, government has no clue what to do. They're not as concerned with some of the same problems that private enterprise has been. Adding to this, is that an enormous amount of the government data processing effort is done by paid contractors. The agencies are responsible for their own websites, for instance. And one of the things that happened during the shutdown was that there were no people watching the websites. There were no people there to maintain them. They could not tell private contractors that they used to maintain them because contractors were shut out as well.
Larry, yes. As our society becomes increasingly wired, or as they say, smart, with critical national infrastructure connected to the...
Say interrelated and interconnected.
Larry, doesn't the fact that our critical systems such as water, energy, finance are more interconnected or network connected, doesn't that make us more hackable?
Again, that's a valid problem that's not really related to the government shutdown, except that government agencies that can provide intelligence to other companies about what is happening at Company A, for example, were not being very effective. They weren't there to give that information. How most of the things you see as far as critical infrastructure are maintained by the companies that actually own that infrastructure. It's not something that the government seems in any way interested to run with, probably because they don't have the expertise that would be necessary to do so, in my opinion.
Larry, what do you imagine a worst-case scenario during a protracted government shutdown? Say we're shut down for February and March. In terms of cybersecurity, what could go wrong, and what would that mean in terms of our daily lives?
We actually had pretty close to the worst-case scenario occur during the last shutdown. The public would probably look at the traffic controllers at LaGuardia going, no, we're not doing this, and say that that was a reason for resumption of the governmental functions. Most people are totally unaware that the Department of Homeland Security issued the first emergency directive it has ever done to correct a cybersecurity problem that was occurring during the shutdown. Without getting too technical, Iran was able to bypass computer traffic, all computer traffic, by accessing one of the major switches using to route that traffic around the world. And they were specifically targeting the U.S. government domains. This would allow them to eavesdrop on all this traffic, as well as get the certificates that would allow them to decrypt that traffic. That's about as bad as it gets when you've got governmental data systems and possibly the underlying systems available to enemies.
Are there any other major risks?
Oh, sure. All the information people depend on from the government, like the Bureau of Labor Statistics. If there's no one there, there's no one there to put the information on a website, even if the certificate has auto-renewed. Some of the certificates were of the type that are called Let's Encrypt. It's a means that's who issued that certificate, as opposed to the older model of a certificate authority. It requires no money or effort to have the certificate renew every 90 days. Some government sites were using that, for instance, cloud.gov and search.gov. Other sites, for whatever reason, again, it may be legacy inertia, have certificates that need both money and manual effort to renew.
Larry, I read that recently one state, their water system was hacked into. I can't recall if it was Russia or China. The government thought it was another nation state. Is that also a risk during a government shutdown, that things we depend on really to live day-to-day existence, like electricity, power, water, chemical refineries, could those be more vulnerable during an attack, and utility plants?
Most of the regulation of those kind of infrastructure plants are done at a more local level. The state may be involved, the locality may be involved, or the company that runs it may be involved. The federal government does oversight, but unless all the levels of government fail, the day-to-day maintenance of such sites in general will go on. That does not mean that they're, again, knowing that someone is attacking a water plant in Arizona may be useful for someone that's defending one in California. In a federal shutdown, that kind of information does not get transmitted. It's easy to think that the federal shutdown actually had more influence than it does, because the federal government now has its tentacles in so many areas. But from a cybersecurity standpoint, it can be resolved if, for instance, President Trump decides to go to the mattresses on February 15th. The agencies involved in such a shutdown might be able to use the experience that they've already had and declare certain more people critical than they did last time around.
Larry, if President Trump decided to hire you as a special cybersecurity consultant for emergency situations like a government shutdown, what would your major points of advice be in terms of keeping an eye on our cybersecurity systems?
First of all, there are existing positions of cybersecurity within this current administration that they have not filled. They have not filled them by choice. So I would think that attempting to tell this administration much about cybersecurity is going to be problematical, if not intensely painful. And I'd best leave it there before I start ranting.
Were you at all impressed with congressional approval of the new Department of Homeland Security cybersecurity agency a couple of months ago? And let me remind our listeners, the government has been creating various committees, task forces, issuing directives for the last 30 years to address the cybersecurity challenges, because in part, as you've said, Larry, their own technology and knowledge is really from the typewriter age. Is this going to make any difference, this new agency, in your opinion?
Yes, I think so. Remember I was talking about that emergency alert? That came from CISA. which is the agency you're talking about. So it has actually done something useful in the avoiding of the political miasma and going to something that is situationally useful. Whether or not they can keep it up is an environmental question I can't answer. The National Institute of Science is especially involved in a lot of cybersecurity research. I mean, we know for a fact the last time this happened in 2013, when the budgeteers decided to hold up a budget because of Obamacare, China did a massive effort in infiltrating the U.S. government's infrastructure. Some people think that the massive data download that happened at the Office of Policy and Management was done because they figured out a way, given this period of lax security, to carry it out. So here we are again. It may be that there is less security risk at this time than there was then, because the agencies may have learned their lesson. I'm going to be a little cynical and say I'm not so sure.
In your opinion, Larry, is the U.S. at most risk from enemy nation states or from hacking groups or rogue actors?
All the above. There's a concept called threat modeling, where you assume, well, no, you don't assume anything. You try and define where a problem for your security will originate from. So you have to answer the question, who has the most interest and who will have the best benefit from attacking a state? People with financial interests, threat actors, will go after companies. They won't try and put ransomware on a federal computer, although they might try it and have tried it on individual cities. The general term used in describing nation-state actors is APT. That stands for Advanced Persistent Threats. They don't just come in, rummage around, and leave. They try and leave ways for them to get back in when they want to. So that's how that term came about. It's far more likely that an APT actor will try to use any advantage, like a time of reduced security for in a governmental system, to set up their next attack. They may not get anything this time, but they've made a bridge for themselves to jump in the next.
If I can translate that, and I may be wrong, an actor could penetrate one of our systems now, but not make us aware of that. In other words, they could sort of lurk or have their own back door into a particular, say, government agency system, but really do the damage in a year or so from now.
Absolutely. There are a number of attacks that we've seen on a postmortem do exactly that.
We have time for another one or two questions. Are there any angles you think are important to bring out that we haven't touched on?
Don't click the link in an unknown email.
I know, right.
No, because okay. It has direct application for this. Social engineering as it's called, is the way that an APT person generally gets in to any system, especially a government system. This is how the Podesta emails were hacked. If a user is aware the threat can happen from something as seemingly innocuous as that, everybody will be better off. Don't click the link unless you're sure of it.
And we should note that a reason social engineering is such a critical part of system penetration is based on the fact that human beings generally are wired to be trusting. So if someone does it the old-fashioned way, picks up the phone, impersonates the boss or someone in a corporation to get password information or learn our habits, that's one of the ways that hackers take advantage of us.
Absolutely. I trust your answer. Security people realize that malware or, you know, infections, what they call on TV the viruses, are not a big a part of the threat as simple social engineering. If people were aware of that social engineering and took the simple steps, for instance, you see a link in an email that wants to be clicked, maybe it's... there will be some golden rainbow at the end of that link that will attract you. Most browsers have a way of showing you what address will be, it will go to if that link is clicked. It is incumbent on everyone, if that feature is available, to use it, to make sure that that link is going to go where you expect it to and not to something unknown or hidden.
Like a fake bank account address.
Like a fake bank account address.
Larry, I've enjoyed reading your articles. How can listeners read your work?
There's two current outlets I have. One is my main outlet, securitynow.com, which is a website devoted to security in all the forms, governmental, Internet of Things, yada, yada. And there's another place called authenticate.com, authentic with the number 8 at the end of it, where I specifically write more about browser security. Those are the current venues I'm working with, although I've been doing this for many years. There's a lot of my writing out there.
Larry Loeb, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you today about cybersecurity and the government shutdown, and we'd love to stay in touch, and thank you for your work.
Always happy to get the word out. If people remember nothing else from our time together, remember this: don't click the link.
Wonderful advice.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIFFM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI, 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS, 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD, 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA, 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR, 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC, 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU, 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI, 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ, 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI, 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW, 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT, 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG, 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL, 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP, 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD, 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP, 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP, 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR, LP, 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising online. KBFG, 107.3, Seattle, Washington. And KKRN, 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG, 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI, 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP, 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP, 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN, 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG, 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP, 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.